I'm underwhelmed. Underwhelmed. 2 million people? Do you recall that? 30,000. Wow. Because things are so much better today, aren't they? Things have resolved. Things are so much happier for the people in Afghanistan and Iraq. Has anybody noticed what's going on? Carnage, bloodshed, we're wiping them all out. We, our country, is wiping all these people out, just like those people wiped out those people called Americans. Do you remember that one all those years back? The people who used to have the feathers in their hair and the wigwams, the Americans, murdered, slaughtered, carnage, genocide by these invaders from our country amongst other countries, yeah?
So what's it like having everybody here today? Do you feel like a sense of solidarity?
You're not listening, are you? Everybody is not here. Most people are not here, are they? We said 30,000, 2 million. Now, how many people in this country know what's going on is so awful, so wrong? They don't know how awful, because quite frankly, the media doesn't show us very much, does it? The media doesn't show us the blood in the body on the... Oh, it shows us a bit of blood on the streets, but it doesn't show us the blown-up babies, does it? Doesn't show us the bodies. Doesn't show us the sheer and utter carnage. They're all dying over there. But hey, folks, our conscience are okay, aren't they? Because we come out on a march, and we can feel, oh, I've done my bit. 30,000, 2 million? How many millions are dead? Do you know what? When 2 million took to the streets, that was good, wasn't it? Bloody good. From all sections of the community, all our people, we stood up. And that 2 million people represented so many more, didn't it? How many people there were waving them off on the coaches? How many people were demonstrating in other cities in our country on that magical day, yeah? And then people came to me and says, they're going to do it. Oh, what can you do? They didn't listen. Why didn't we come back with 5 million, 10 million? Why didn't we? Why didn't we? 30,000? Wow, I'm underwhelmed. Are we really going to give a shit? Oh, these people are going to be dead by the time we actually do something about it. Because the bottom line is, of course, Bush and Blair committed the same crime that the Nazis were hung for at Nuremberg. Do you know the number one crime? To initiate a war of aggression is the number one crime. From that crime, all the other war crimes come. Yeah? It's common sense, isn't it, when you think about it? 45 minutes, Mr. Blair. 45 minutes, Mr. Blyer. Dodgy dossiers. Plagiarized thesis. 45 minutes, sexy lie. And for that, all the innocents have to die. That's how it started, isn't it? 5 years ago now. 5 years ago. 5 years. Do you know what? I'm sure the people of Iraq and Afghanistan are so grateful to us. After murdering at least 2 million of their people, we're here saying, oh, it's naughty, stop. And then we're going away again, aren't we?
Are you going away or not?
I wish I could. With all my heart, I wish I could go away. 7 years, 24/7 on this pavement. What's happening over there? Well, everybody's being murdered. Check out the arms industry, the number one money-making business in the world. It's all about money. Check out the drugs industry, the second biggest money-making racket in the world. Check out the drugs coming from Afghanistan. That's what it's all about. The Taliban regime, this wicked, awful regime, cut the drugs back to 150 tons, the poppy production, yeah? It's gone up to 5,000-6,000 tons and growing now. We've liberated them. Second biggest money-making racket. Oh, some people are making a fortune out of this. And on our streets, the people are being controlled with the drugs. We did that to the Chinese people all those years ago with opium, didn't we? Turned them into zombies. And our people are fucking zombies. I'm sorry. Drinking? Drugs? When are we going to wake up and care? When are we going to be human? I'm here because I'm personally responsible for what my country is doing to other people, am I not? I can't just blame it all on Blair, who's gone now. But his genocide lives on, doesn't it? Check out depleted uranium munitions. It's our war material. It's made of our nuclear waste. We dropped a couple of thousands of tons of our nuclear shit on people in other countries.
It all does sound a bit depressing. Have you got any sort of positive vision for the future? Do you think things may turn around?
Oh, yes, it's very depressing, isn't it? And all those poor, depressed people over there. I tell you what, when the bombs are falling on you, you get a bit depressed. And over here, we get a bit, oh, it's going to rain. It started spitting, isn't it? Everybody's going to run away home soon. They're going to run away home. When are we going to care? When are we going to wake up? When are we going to stop? What Bush and Blair are doing is far worse than Hitler ever did. Check out depleted uranium. I didn't tell you, did I? Depleted uranium, the Royal Society tells us, has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. We poison these people's countries forever. See what it does to the babe? For God's sake, look to see what we're doing to the babies. Hiroshima, Nagasaki. Go to Southeast Asia. You'll see the same effect from Agent Orange there. Same. Go to Serbia, Sarajevo, Yugoslavia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, Iraq. Depleted uranium munitions. Depressing. I'm sorry to spoil your day. Sorry to make you a bit miserable.
Well, I wanted to get from you is, do you have a positive vision for the future? Do you think things may turn around?
What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? I don't want to know your answer. That's between you and your maker, between you and your conscience. Have you noticed what... Check out the Statutes of Rome, Article 25. That talks about individual criminal responsibility. If my country is committing genocide and I'm paying money towards, tax money towards buying the weapons, buying the depleted uranium munitions, the bombs, I'm personally responsible. In the same way as the German people were personally responsible for what Hitler and the Nazis did. And they had a collective punishment after the end of the Second World War. Do we know about that? What I would say is for our people to have a heart. Are we really monsters? See, we're already thinning out. The rain's coming and the people are running away because it's uncomfortable, isn't it? I tell you what, it's bloody uncomfortable in Iraq and Afghanistan. Ask our soldiers how comfortable they are. Ask them, do they want to be there? Is anybody going to give a shit about our soldiers? General Danet ran away from me the other day. Have you heard of him? General Danet Donut, our top general. Oxford Union, he should have been speaking against me. This House would, under no circumstances, fight for Queen and country. That was the motion. I was speaking for it. Danet was supposed to be speaking against it. He didn't turn up. The Air Marshal, he was supposed to be turning up instead of Danet. He didn't turn up.
Do you think our public Colonel, figures are afraid to debate these subjects?
Colonel Bob Andrews, the action man from Basra, he was going to come. He didn't turn up. He had business in the Middle East, apparently. Yeah, it's called genocide. That's what it's called. It's called bomb, burn, bugger, beggar your neighbour. That's what it's called. But he's just doing what he's told. And most of us do what we're told, don't we? And we march nice and peacefully between the crowd barriers like we're supposed to do. We're penned in. Do you know the way to change things? No, it's not with a revolution. It's not with force, not with violence. It's with peace. That's what buggers them off about me, you know. Absolute. Are you an absolute pacifist, Brian? Oh, can you be a partial pacifist? Are you against all war? Well, check out war. Check out what it's for. War's for making money. That's what war's for. Check out the innocents who die in war. And it's the most innocent who do most of the dying. Have you noticed that? The babes, the infants, the old people, the weak, the sick, the poor. These are the people who do the big dying in war. The ones in uniform. And they've been taught to protect themselves, haven't they? To keep their head down. Well, some of them have. Some of them haven't had a chance to, have they? Their head's blown off before they've had a chance to learn. But are you going to give a damn for that soldier boy? Could be your child, couldn't he? He is our child. So is this little Arabian child as well. That's our child. Are we human beings, Britain? Wake up. Stop the genocide. Do something about it. And do it while there's still some people left.
This is the Global Research News Hour. I'm Michel Trostadowski from Montreal, Canada. Visit our website. We cover the news and public affairs on a daily basis with incisive analysis, both on the national as well as international scene. We're joined from London, United Kingdom, Felicity Arbuthnot, who is a war correspondent, author, human rights advocate, and she will be bringing us up to date on the evolving situation in the Middle East, focusing particularly on war crimes and human rights. Hello, Felicity.
Hello.
Are you there?
Yes, I certainly am. Good evening. Yes. Good evening from London.
Well, welcome to America, Felicity. It's St. Patrick's Day, is it not?
I was just going to say, happy St. Patrick's Day.
Well, happy St. Patrick's Day. You're actually born in Ireland, are you not?
I was, yes.
Yes. Well, it's there's several important events today and this week. Certainly St. Patrick's Day is one of them, but also 40 years ago is the anniversary. It's the anniversary of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, and one has to remember these events because in effect they're part of an evolving pattern. And I was very much struck when I started, of course, reading up again on the My Lai massacre, that one of the individuals behind the cover-up was Colin Powell.
That's absolutely
now,
right.
Yes, and of course Colin Powell was also involved in the in what you described as Operation Desert Slaughter. That was
That's
the
right.
1991. You were there, were you not? At
No, I wasn't actually there. I was there shortly afterwards. But the interesting thing, just to pick you up on Colin Powell, was how he wrote After My Lie, just the same, I mean, the parallels of what we are hearing now about, you know, the few bad apples in the barrel. The rolling back, it's as if we've returned to the same textbooks that they wrote in Vietnam, just to sort of break off for a moment from where I know you want to go. And the only voice of sanity seemed to come from, it was McNamara, who was then, in charge of defense, who says, his deputy said, this war has been characterized by a substantial majority of the population regarding the establishment of having gone out of their minds. You know, we seem to be revisiting the same old ground, don't we?
So we've gone absolutely out of our minds in terms of military procedures and the way in which the world is being run.
Yes, I mean, there are no military procedures, are there? It's just, again, you know, Vietnam. I mean, there were endless reports that were sent back about, you know, how the natives were so recalcitrant and they seemed to be very reluctant to be moved from their homes. Indeed, one is. And so they just bombed the villages, and then apparently that concentrated the mines, and then they moved. And we appear to be, again, you know, bombing the entire country in order to save it, and that's Iraq. You wanted to talk about...
And you said when you looked at what was happening 17 years ago during the so-called Gulf War, you described this situation of how the United States and Britain had carpet bombed an entire country. You reflected on the retreating Iraqi troops. How does this relate to My Lai? Is it part of a continuum? Is it an evolving?
I think it is part of a continuum, absolutely. And there are absolutely numerous deliberate, I mean, My Lai, the public woke up, but anyone who has read Vietnam, you know that My Lai was just one horror that got out. There were numerous, numerous more. And they'd also done a very strange thing in that this is exactly what's happening now, and this is not to sort of denigrate people who haven't been lucky, but they reduced the sort of IQ level of people who went into the army to virtually zero, and this is what is happening now. You know, people here in Britain, for instance, they're taking people with so few qualifications that that many of the military who are going in, and this is the same I understand in the States, they have to go to the sort of kindergarten books and be taught to read and write. I think the one is called Jack and Jill, or John and Jill, or Joan and Jill, or something. You know, I mean, we really are talking about sort of seven, eight year old level. So how can you teach, you know, to people who have been very unfortunate any kind of rules and regulations at all? It just, you know, how do you explain the Nuremberg Convention? How do you explain the Geneva? How do you, you know, even given the fear of being in the situation that they are?
But
you know, going back to the Basra Road, which, you know, that I suppose you could call that Iraq's My Lie, but then since you can call so many things My Lie. You know, Maggie O'Kane of The Guardian describes the most terrifying episode when they were burying young Iraqis alive, and she describes a young soldier called Joe Queen who'd been awarded a Bronze Star, and he was just 19 years old, and he went with his colleagues across the Saudi border in an armored bulldozer and just buried Iraqi conscript troops alive in their trenches, and then covered the trenches real smooth so the rest of the 1st Armored Mechanized Brigade could come in nice and easily behind them. He doesn't even know how many Iraqi troops he buried alive on the front line, but 5 years later he remembered how it worked, and he said the sand was so soft that once the blade hit the sand, it just caved in on the side, so we never did go back and forth. And he said you did it so much you would close your eyes and do it. And then he describes, you know, young people walking along with their hands up trying to surrender, and he said they just bulldozed them in.
But the orders were given from high up.
The orders were given.
This is typically one has a tendency to say, well, it's the individual servicemen and women who commit irregular decisions, but in this particular case, it was General Norman Schwarzkopf and Colin Powell who were calling the strings, the strings.
Absolutely. And I mean, it was Schwarzkopf, wasn't it, who at the end of the Gulf War said, the 1991 war, said triumphantly, there was no one left to kill.
No, I remember I remember that sentence. I remember it. And in effect, the Iraq War has been ongoing for how many years?
Well, it never ended, because the embargo, which was imposed on both Kuwait and Iraq on, ironically, Hiroshima Day 1990, was lifted on Kuwait after the end of the 1991 42-day sort of carpet bombing, but stayed on in Iraq, remembering, of course, that Iraq imported 70% of just about everything, and that included maintenance for hospital equipment, machinery, and so on. So a country where their whole base of manufacture, of agriculture, every single thing had been absolutely devastated, flattened. The schools, the radio station, I mean, just think of anything, hospitals. And then they weren't allowed to import building materials. They weren't allowed to, get in their usual contractors to help. most of the bridges, because of course the country is divided by the great Tigris and Euphrates rivers, had been bombed, and these enormously complicated, and they were six-lane highways, you know, to rebuild. So they were left with absolutely nothing, with the electricity off, with the telephones off, and of course if the electricity is off, it's not just your fridge that goes off, it's the incubators, it's the life support machines, it's everything needed to sustain also a civil society. And the embargo just stayed on in this, what I call, a sort of war of the moving goalposts. You know, Saddam wasn't complying with this, Saddam wasn't complying with that, and 25 million people suffered, and it now looks as actually virtually everything he said, not everything, but, you know, games happen in these sort of situations, but, you know, he was telling the truth. We just kept moving, you know, arm-twisting the United Nations, Britain and America, and the goalposts kept moving. And year by year, everything just got worse and worse and worse.
Felicity will be back after the break. We're talking to Felicity Arbuthnot, a war correspondent and analyst of the Middle East. We're back with Global Research News Hour, which is coming to you from Montreal, Canada. Our website is www.globalresearch.ca. We're talking to Felicity Arbuthnot, war correspondent, analyst, and author with an extensive knowledge of the Middle East. Welcome back, Felicity.
Thank you. Very nice to be back. I wanted go ahead.
I just wanted to relate this to the U.S. political scene, because in effect, if the war on Iraq has been ongoing since 1991, or even perhaps before that.
No, really, August 1990.
When the embargo was commenced. That's correct. But we're looking at several U.S. administrations, and throughout the 1990s, which were the Clinton years, we had a war on Iraq, and then we had a war on Iraq under the Bush administration, the first Bush administration was also involved. So how do you view the Democrats in this context? Are the Democrats providing an alternative? Are they? John McCain is in favor of a continued military presence, and he supports the war. The Democrats are a little bit not so clear on that.
Well, John McCain, I mean, appears to be, you know, what has he said? He doesn't care if it goes on for 100 years or 10,000 years. I mean, but I don't know. Barack Obama seems to be extremely, I know he says, you know, he addresses pulling the American troops out, but actually if you look at the substance, it's pretty wobbly. There's no absolutes there, unless I have missed something. And I think one also has to remember to what extent America and Israel are making policies in this, and he has come down very firmly behind Israel, you know, and says that, you know, if you look, for instance, on his statement at a Palestinian state, he said absolutely no, hasn't he? That it would be a threat to Israel. So I don't know. Obama worries me. Hillary Clinton worries me worse.
Yes.
And John McCain scares the life out of me. And I think, you know, it's difficult to know, you know, which is the least bad of a really awful bunch. I mean, that's my personal view.
Yeah, well, neither you nor I are going to be voting in the U.S. elections, but certainly I share that understanding. But on the other hand, I think that this war agenda is not really driven by governments. It's driven by very powerful corporate lobby groups.
Absolutely.
Which buy up the candidates and so on. It's
yes.
So that, I think in Britain you have the same kind of underlying situation where Tony Blair is really an instrument, or was an instrument, of a military agenda, but he was certainly not taking decisions on his own in any regard.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think that Tony Blair is a man for all seasons. You know, he wasn't, snap your fingers, you know, whether it was George W. Bush or Clinton before him, or the corporate, as you say, you know, the corporate lobby, and Blair would simply say, how high? You know, I don't think that either side of the Atlantic we're looking at any towering integrity almost anywhere. There are a couple of honourable exceptions, but not many of them, and the honourable exceptions are not in a high enough place to make any difference.
But in fact, I think more fundamentally, we're looking at people who are war criminals who occupy high positions in government.
This is absolutely right. I mean, a friend of mine said in despair yesterday about, you know, Blair now teaching, you know, he's got all these, 5 million from J.P. Morgan as an advisor, you know, half a day a week or whatever it is, you know, the advance on his book. He's now going to teach faith and conflict resolve, it seems like, for want of a better words, at Yale, and he's got all his speaking engagements, and she just said totally despairingly, you know, if he wants to have a public platform, it should be in the dock at the War Crimes Tribunal at The Hague, and I think that should go for the whole darn lot of them.
Yeah, but that's not really happening, is it?
It's not going to happen, is it?
It's not going to happen, because they actually, the war criminals control that court, and they'll send the people they want to send there.
I mean,
that, I think, is the situation we're in, particularly in the United States of America, where high office, George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, are responsible for having ordered major war crimes against people of the Middle East, and this is the situation that we're in. We'll be back after the commercial break with Felicity Arbuthnot. This is Michel Chossadovsky. We're back with the Global Research News Hour. I'm Michel Chossadovsky from the Center for Research on Globalization. Our website is www.globalresearch.ca. We're talking to Felicity Arbuthnot on the evolving situation in the Middle East. Felicity, there's one theme which is very crucial in understanding what's happening in Iraq, and that is the flow of media information from the war theater. We know that several Western journalists have been killed or assassinated as a means to silence those reports, and that in fact what is coming out still today from Iraq is really the embedded reports. It's the reports which are approved by the occupation forces. Could you perhaps tell us a bit your experience in this regard?
Yes, I absolutely can. And just to point out that until the invasion, Colombia was considered the most dangerous place on earth for journalists. And in 10 years, this was last year's figures actually, 26 journalists are being killed. Both Iraqi and Western journalists in the 5 years of the invasion, just coming up to 5 years, 3 days on from now, nearly 300 journalists or media workers helping them have been killed. And I think you are absolutely right. I mean, there is a theme in this that almost without exception, they have been the freelancers, they have been the people with, you know, who weren't prepared to be silenced, weren't prepared to be embedded, and that applies to the independent-minded aid workers, people like Margaret Hassan, who was, you know, she stood up to Saddam and she would certainly have stood up to the invasion. And interestingly, I was going back to Iraq in November 2002, and I was just rushing to finish a very short documentary for Channel 4, and I was doing the interviews, and these were Iraqis who were against the regime, Saddam's regime, but who were absolutely implacably against Iraq suffering anymore and against the invasion. And as I was taking one, showing one very eminent and well-placed Iraqi out of the building where we'd been filming, he looked at me and he said, that Iraqi Bush Telegraph, I tell you, and he said, I gather you're going back to Iraq in the next couple of days. And I said, yes. And he put his arm around my shoulder and he said, don't go. He said, if you do and they invade, because if you remember, you know, late 2002, we were already thinking the invasion could be any day. He said, they will kill you. And I just laughed, and I said, oh, don't be silly, I'm not worth it to them. And he said, no, take me seriously, you know, they will. Anyway, I went back, and then I went back in the February, March 2003, and I left because I had some tapes that I needed to get out about 3 days before the invasion. And then the first thing they did, of course, was shoot up the Palestine Hotel and killed the journalists there. That was literally as they were coming over the 40th.
I remember that very
yeah.
well.
And then Al Arabiya, and, you know, the killing of journalists has gone on ever since. It's as if they wanted to silence anybody with a voice.
Yeah.
If you remember Enzo Baldoni, the very independent-minded Italian journalist, he was beheaded in Nasiriyah, and I mean there's just been a litany, and it's going on to this day. And journalists too are supposed to be some kind of independence and protection under the Geneva Convention, but conventions seem to be just chucked out of the window by the two rogue states, Britain and America.
I recall also that on the 9th of April when
yes.
when the US troops went in, there was a mission of the Red Cross, which was fired upon.
That's right.
And the representative of the International Committee of the Red Cross was killed. Now, he was in charge of steering aid to the hospitals, but as a result of that incident, in fact, he was a Canadian, and there was virtually no coverage, but they killed him, and they said, oh, it was crossfire. But as a result of that, the International Committee of the Red Cross retreated, closed their mission, and in fact abandoned their historical role, which is that of monitoring, you know, detention camps and so on.
Right. So the Britain and America and the coalition of the not very willing, you know, had a completely free hand. And it is still not known how many secret prisons that there are in Iraq. I mean, we've heard about Abu Ghraib. I would lay money that there are many, many Abu Ghraibs throughout Iraq. We don't know what's going on at the prison, at the airport. You know, there are just more questions than answers. And by the way, going back to the journalists momentarily, the media organizations like Al Arabiya and of course the Palestine, they'd all given their coordinates to the Central Command. So, you know, not much room for error there, one would have thought. I remember way back 1999 when I went to co-edit a whole edition of the New Internationalist magazine on Iraq, and the insurance people would only insure us if we gave the coordinates, if we gave our route, where we were going, where we were going to be on every single day. And since, of course, the British and American were bombing Iraq for the whole of the 13 years of the embargo entirely illegally, you know, I remember saying, you know, I'd rather not be insured. In your dreams am I going to tell them where I'm going to be, just in case it would be passed on. You know, again, your thing about, you know, insurance companies are very large, and they
have the cell phones as well.
Exactly.
I mean, the journalists were holding cell phones, and they knew their coordinates, and they
That's
could.
It.
And in fact, if I recall, it was a British or Irish journalist, and she had been threatened, and they said, "Well, we know your cell phone coordinates. We can spot you on the GPS, and you'll get it if you don't conform to certain behavior of reporting." I mean, it's killing the truth. In effect, that's really what we're dealing with. It's the criminalization of media and the printed press.
My friend Neil Mackay brings that up in his book, The War on Truth, and that's why he called it that. At every level, it's a war on truth. And yet, funnily enough, if you'd allow me a slight aside, yes, there were those threats, and you're bringing them out absolutely aptly and rightly. And yet, when Margaret Hassan was kidnapped, a woman with a very big voice and who had spoken at the UN and said, just before the invasion, and said there'll be another lost generation of Iraqi children, and, you know, Iraq was just staggering under the weight of the bombings and the embargo. And then she spoke at the Foreign Affairs thing in Parliament here. When she was kidnapped, somebody else, you know, as I say, I really can't stress enough, it is a huge coincidence that these are all brave, independent voices. Her husband was rung three times on her mobile from people who said they were the kidnappers. Well, they certainly had her mobile. And the kidnappers, alleged kidnappers, were saying they wanted to get in touch with the British Embassy. So clearly there was some concern, and I mean, she was a very loved person. Maybe they were criminals and had a second thought. Who knows? But it was worth a go.
She was a good friend of yours, huh?
She was a dear friend of mine.
Yeah.
And the British Embassy refused to speak three times, and her husband was left in the house begging them to speak to these people, and they refused. So it's very odd how they can threaten some people, and something that might possibly have, it just might have saved her, they refused. And I find that very, very sinister.
In other words, one suspects that these alleged kidnappers were in fact controlled by US intelligence, or that they were sent in on some, and then of course they blame it on the terrorists.
Absolutely. I think there are many people who believe that, you know, various members of the government at the time, that was Iyad Alawi's government, were deeply involved, and their strings were simply being pushed and pulled, as you say, by, well, mainly America, but with Britain, you know, tagging along. We really have, you know, it's been shameful. And don't forget also that during the embargo years, 1992, March 2003, not only were there continual bombings, but it is estimated that 1.25 million people died of embargo-related causes. That, of course, is the UN's expression, and the worst hit being the newborn and the under fives. You know, war against children. And those figures are probably a way under guesstimate, because people got so desperate in, you know, a country sitting on the second largest oil reserves on earth, that very often, in spite of the, you know, the agony of losing somebody and watching them die, sometimes for want of very simple medications, they didn't report the death because it would mean that they lost the food rations, these pathetic food rations that the majority of households, as the years went on, relied on. And these, they would only last for, if you were very careful, for maybe 22, 23, 24 days a month. And they didn't declare deaths because they needed that extra ration for the rest of the family. I mean, how low can the international community and the United Nations sink?
Yeah. But when we add the if we draw a balance sheet of this war, we're talking about 500,000 deaths before 2003, and then according to the John Hopkins study, which was published by The Lancet,
yep,
we're talking about probably close to 2 million now.
Yes,
so we're 2 million civilian casualties in Iraq. And all of that was waged on the pretext of going after Bin Laden and his
and weapons of mass destruction
and supposed weapons of mass destruction, which of course only the United States and Britain have, and Israel, they have their weapons of mass destruction, but they are.
Don't forget that in December 2002, the Iraqis delivered 11,800-page dossier, not a dodgy one, a truthful one, to the United Nations weapons inspectors at the UN building in New York. And the Americans, so there's only one word for it, actually stole it. They went into the office, they said that they would photocopy it. Apparently the UN doesn't have photocopies, so it could be handed round to the Security Council, etc. And they returned just under 3,800 pages, I think it was, off the top of my head, so heavily censored that when I rang every single member of the non-permanent members at the time of the Security Council, they said it wasn't even, you couldn't understand any of it at all. It was completely illegible. And they all said that never in all their time as the UN had they been aware, had they had anything like this ever happened. And they were ballistic, absolutely ballistic. But not one of them was brave enough to put their head over the parapet and be named.
Yeah, it's a pretty, I mean, this whole process is a tremendous balance sheet of loss of life, destruction of countries, and it's waged in the name of making the world safer with humanitarian nuclear bombs, which the United States wants to use now against Iran. And then, of course, you have to torture the alleged terrorists because they threaten our security, and that's what the Bush administration is telling us with regard to the numerous civilians who have been captured and are being held in concentration camps, not solely Guantanamo, but others.
And secret prisons.
And secret prisons.
Don't know where they are. I mean, when Craig Murray, the former ambassador to Uzbekistan, kept sending, because Uzbekistan apparently is Britain and America's friend, kept sending desperate messages to the Foreign and Commonwealth Office here to say, you know, this is a regime who is boiling, not just torturing, had actually boiled a prisoner to death. He was so hounded by his bosses at the Foreign and Commonwealth Office that he, and he's a tough man, I know him, he actually had a really severe mental breakdown.
Yeah.
You know, it makes you wonder where the real rogue states are. And you know, Michelle, one can talk about these huge figures of both the embargo years and, as you say, since the invasion, of the utterly innocent lives. But behind those figures, which people sort of glaze over, you know, as you know, I could tell you 1,000 stories, but there are ones that just stick in my mind. And if I could just, you know, the victims, if I could just tell you just one, and it was two children, one of 5 and one of 3, who had acute myeloid leukemia, and they're in a ward on their own in a hospital in Baghdad, which had formerly been very, very sophisticated. And they had cancer treatments were vetoed, and that now still there are no cancer treatments getting through in spite of this enormous spike in cancers because of the weapons used. And they were just covered in bruises because the veins and capillaries were just leaking, and they were in agony, absolute agony. And the three-year-old, whose name translated as the vital one, Ali Lazam, he was. And I looked at him, and his eyes were full of tears, and he was lying absolutely rigid. And I realized he'd actually taught himself not to cry, because that would shudder his little body further. And I knew then it was actually possible to die of shame for what's being done in our name.
We'll be back after the break with Felicity Arbuthnot, final 4 or 5 minutes of the program. This is Michel Jostedowski from Global Research Montreal, our website, www.globalresearch.ca. We're back with the Global Research News Hour. This is Michel Jostedowski from Montreal, Canada. Our website is www.globalresearch.ca. We're talking to Felicity Arbuthnot, Middle East war correspondent, analyst, and author, who has joined us from London, United Kingdom. We just have a few more minutes, Felicity. Could you tell us a little bit about what's happening in the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, particularly now that Tony Blair is not there anymore? Is this for rejoicing or not?
Well, I suppose anything that gets rid of Tony Blair, you know, you might lift a, I don't know, maybe a thimble full of something. But no, there's absolutely no change whatsoever. Gordon Brown today, of course, has announced that there will be an investigation, a proper independent investigation of the invasion of Iraq, but not quite yet.
Oh, now, he said not quite yet.
No, not quite yet. We're going to wait until our boys are back. You know, our boys, he doesn't seem to have realised, are again committing, just by having their feet on the soil in this illegal war, you know, the supreme international, you know, the supreme, yes, international crime under Nuremberg. So no, it's more, you know, moving the deck chairs on the Titanic, frankly.
Well, what about the sexed up report on the death of David Kelly? Maybe remind listeners in the UK is that David Kelly was a scientist who had inside information on weapons of mass destruction and was found dead, and then the causes of his death were covered up by a royal commission and an autopsy and so on and so forth. How do you view that situation? It's maybe too late in the program to talk about it.
And he miraculously managed to move his body after he had died. I have one... There's one interesting fact that's not come out over Kelly, and, well, there's been a lot of, as you know, a lot of very hard material and also a lot of speculation. However, do you remember the Niger uranium?
Joe
Wilson, the ambassador, who went because Iraq was buying... uranium from Niger, allegedly. Well, actually, not only did that, of course, turn out to be another pack of lies, but Iraq has swathes of uranium, and there was a team sent to find how much they had, because they did want to become, being threatened all the time, self-sufficient in weapons, and there's no secret about that, after the 1991 war. And they found it all over the Western Road and all the rest of it. And they found the biggest deposits in northern Iraq. And what they also found was a huge amount of drilling equipment. And they went round to the villages. These are the Iraqi scientists. There were 50 of them, real experts. And said, you know, where did all this old rusted drilling equipment come from? And all the villagers consistently said, oh, that's when the British were here drilling for uranium in the 1950s. Now, I wonder whether, I mean, Kelly would have known that, and somewhere in the Ministry of Defence here in the United Kingdom, there must be all the files from all that research they did in Iraq in the 50s. Did he threaten in some way to blow that? He would have known all that stuff.
Felicity, I think we're running to the end of the show. We were talking to Felicity Arbuthnot. This is Michelle Chosadovsky of the Global Research on the Global Research News Hour. Join us next week at 11 Central Time. Our website, www.globalresearch.ca.